another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter.
Hi, this is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, where we talk about how you can live the life you want if times get tough or even if they don't. Yet another edition of the podcast dictated on my 50-mile drive. This time it is on my 50-mile drive in the morning. It's a beautiful sunny morning here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. It hasn't gotten hot yet. 83 degrees. The temperature's gone up 3 degrees since I got in the car. So that tells you that we're in for another one of those really hot days. And if you live up in the Northeast or the Northwest or somewhere in the mountains, I bet you're enjoying life right now. But let me talk to you around January or February about that temperature. Anyway, we're not here to talk about the weather. I just like to start getting people a little more familiar with who I am and where I'm at so we can kind of get to know each other. We're going to spend some time together every day, hopefully, and you should get to know a little bit more about me and where I live and what the weather's like. It's one of those things that you use with friends, and that's what I consider the people that tune into this podcast, like friends. I don't care what your social leanings are. I don't care what your political leanings are. We have something in common. We believe that the world as we know it is changing for various reasons, and that things are not all perfect and safe the way that we are led to believe by the media, the way that we are led to believe by our governments, the way that we are led to believe by just the way that society acts as a whole. We get that there is something going on. And if I sound a little clearer today, if I don't have as much going on in the background, it's because I tried a simple solution to the noise issue, and I've just picked up a simple little $9 lapel mic to go with my recorder instead of using the mic that's built into it. We'll see how this one comes out. I think it's going to be a lot clearer, at least I hope so. Anyway, on to today's subject. What are we going to talk today about? We're going to talk about the money supply, the actual amount of money circulating around in the economy. And if you think that's going to be boring, I challenge you, man, stay with me. I'm going to try to make this entertaining, engaging, and exciting and explain to you why this stuff matters, because it does matter. The reality is the figures that I'm going to give you today, the things that I'm going to talk about are out there for anybody to find. I found them today looking around on the internet in about 15 minutes to get these numbers. So anyway, let's start out with what I mean by the money supply. I'm talking about dollars in circulation, total amount of U.S. dollars out there. And there are four different factors that are published numbers, at least they were published numbers. Now only three of the four are published. They stopped publishing one in 2006. And they're called the M scale, or the M factors, and they run from M0 to M3. And again, I'm talking about dollars, total number of dollars. If you pulled them all out of a single location, stacked them up, how many would there be? And M0 is the number that talks about what we would consider fluid cash. This number's available. You can go to the Fed and get that number from their site. You can get it from various sources all over the web. It's been published for a long time, and they continue to publish it like they should. And what I mean by fluid cash is this is all the money that's kind of sloshing around out there in the economy right now. The stuff that changes hands on a daily basis. The money that's not sitting in a bank account. Just the money floating around, okay? Pretty easy to understand. If it's not being held somewhere and it's in the economy being spent, handed from one hand to another, it's part of M0. Then there's M1. M1 is M0 plus your checking account and everybody else's checking account out there. So checking accounts are, money comes in, money goes out, but generally people have an average balance. Now, unfortunately for many Americans, their average balance is very low, but for a lot of people and for a lot of families, there is a fairly constant balance. So when you look at the M1 factor, you include that money. So again, we're trying to track that. How much money's out there would make sense to count it all, right? When we get to M3, you'll see how the Fed says, no, we don't need to do that anymore. So M2 is M0 plus M1, right? And that means it has all the money that's circulating, all the money that's out there in checking accounts, It also includes small deposits, anything that's been deposited into like savings accounts or things like that, or various other lending assets like CDs and things like that, that are under $100,000. Keep that number in mind. Any transaction like that that's under $100,000. It includes your savings accounts, the savings accounts of the worker bees all across the United States, which again, I think that number is way too little money in there, but there's a lot of it if you add it up. So, you know, the Fed and their geniusness says if we're going to keep track of the money supply, we should stay in touch with that money too. That money's a, you know, it adds up. It's real money. And individual money market accounts. So in addition to your savings account, if you invest in the stock market and things like that, but you hold some of your cash, all right, in a money market account, which is maybe pays a little better interest rate than a savings account, and it's readily available to move into stocks or mutual funds as you need it. So we're going to put all that in there. Makes sense, right? We want to know how much money is there. Now let's talk about M3. M3 is the most comprehensive measurement of the money supply. M3 includes all the things I just talked about, plus it includes large deposits of over $100,000. Now, you might think about the fact that we're one of the largest countries in the world from an economic standpoint, and that we have big companies that often do deposits over $100,000. M2 does not take those into the equation. That money's not accounted for in M2. Keep this in mind, because I'm going to explain to you why this all matters to you in just a second. It also includes institutional money market funds. That means that IBM's money market account, for instance, or Yahoo, or Google, or Microsoft's money market accounts are in the M3 equation, not the M2, M1, or M0. As you can imagine, these large companies hold fairly large amounts of money like this because they have to have cash on hand to do things like pay their employees, all right? It also includes all the U.S. dollars that are currently held in Canada and the United Kingdom. That's real money too, folks. That adds up to a lot of money. As you can imagine, there's quite a bit of U.S. money in Canadian hands and in hands of people in the United Kingdom. It also includes what are called repurchase agreements. Now, what a repurchase agreement is let's say I need money from the bank and I'm IBM. And I issue the bank a million shares of IBM stock for a set price. But in that repurchase agreement, I agree to buy the stock back from the bank at a higher price at some specific point in the future. So it's a way for me to borrow money without it looking like borrowed money. If you can imagine a little bit, that tends to go on out there in corporate America, especially big public companies. They do a lot of things like that to pull more cash into the system without actually having to put it on an accounts payable ledger. So what I'm saying is that the amount of dollars inside the M3 number add up to a lot of money, a ton of money, an awful lot of money. Now let me ask you a question. If you were the Federal Reserve System and your sole job is to produce, account for, and control the money supply, that's what they do. Control, account for, produce, and manage the money supply. Wouldn't you want to know how many dollars you have? Wouldn't that number be important? And wouldn't you think that leaving out things like large deposits over $100,000, institutional money market accounts, the U.S. dollars that are outside of our country in the hands of our two biggest allies, and these backdoor repurchase agreements between banks and major corporations that sum up to billions of dollars, that those dollars should be accounted for? And that if you're responsible to report to the American people who are your boss, and to the American government who are your boss, where all this stuff is, that you would include that in your reports. Makes perfect sense, and it's what they did. They did it all the way up until 2006. In 2006, the Fed said to us, you know what, American people, you know what, American government, this M3 thing's really not that important. It doesn't really give you any indication of what's going on that's any more important than M2. And it costs us money. I mean, you know, this stuff is expensive, all these things we print this stuff on, and all these accountants that are, you know, managing stuff, and the slide rulers are going, and the computers and the Excel spreadsheets. It's all costs real money. So we want to save money. So what we're going to do is we're going to stop publishing the M3 number. Well, just call Michelle too. You can use that. It's good enough. What? What the hell are you talking about? How the hell can that be good enough? People, if that doesn't anger you, if that doesn't frustrate you, if that doesn't just hit you in the side of the head and go, something's not right here, then please wake up and please grab onto this concept. What they're saying is all those dollars do not need to be accounted for to you and I and to our government officials. No one needs to know about that. It's okay, don't worry about it. You don't need to know the total quantity of money that's out there. Now, why the hell did this happen? Well, I'll tell you why it happens. Because even the uneducated consumer, the guy that's asleep, the guy that tunes into Fox Business News, you know, once a day for 10 minutes, just to know whether he needs to call his financial advisor and say, hey, man, move some of this stock, or, you know, let's go into funds for a while or something. This is not good. I want to. Then that guy, the average working stiff, the upper middle class guy that votes, that occasionally will pick the phone up and call his congressman, he's not really involved, but you know what? In spite of his apathy, he's paying a little bit of attention. Even him, and even people a little less informed than him, when they see a graph with the M3 money supply going up 8% a year, intrinsically they know something's wrong. And that's what the M3 supply was doing up until 2006. It was annually increasing by 8%. Now, you may wonder, what the hell does that mean? Like, it sounds bad, but what does it really mean? Again, it's just a total number of dollars out there in circulation. And I'm going to, before I go into what all this has done to us and what this all really means and how much it's really costing us and why it's driving up the price of goods and services and putting us at a disadvantage in the world and all these other things, I'm going to explain to you again why, and I'm going to do this probably in a lot of podcasts, why more money produced is bad for us, the American citizen who spends and earns dollars. Again, when you produce more money, it's like splitting stocks or issuing more stocks against the country, shares of stock. Now again, if you're holding Exxon stock, you have 1,000 shares, the price of Exxon stock hits $150 a share, and Exxon decides that investors are going to look at that number and go, you know, that's too pricey. So what they do is they say, we're going to split our shares in half, which means we're going to double the number of Exxon shares. Now that's good for you as an investor in general in the stock market, because what happens is your stock now will plummet to $75, but you'll go from having 1,000 shares to 2,000 shares. So you have the exact same amount of value in stock. There's no loss for you. And the stocks that do this tend to generally begin to go back up relatively quickly because people see that as a move of a company that's growing and innovating and doing better. And since that's the case, more money pours in, which is one of the reasons they do it. It's designed to stimulate more investing. Okay? And generally speaking, it works very well. Okay, you own less of a piece of the company for each share, but the existing shareholders, the people already holding the shares, get their shares doubled. Unfortunately for us, holding dollars in our bank accounts and our mutual funds and everything we own is priced and valued in dollars. When the government throws 8% more money, they devalue the money that's already in the system by the same 8%. They push the value of the money down 8%. Why? Because when they issue 8% more money, they don't send 8% more money to you and me. They don't send it to the American consumer. They put it into corporate America. They use it as emergency loans. They pump it into the system at the very highest levels and hope trickle-down economics take over. All right? They starve off depression and recession with this influx of money. They give the banks more money. The banks can't hold the money. The banks got to figure out a way to loan it, to get it out there, to get it leveraged, because the bank has to pay the Fed interest on the money. The lending institution has to pay the Fed interest on that money that's printed, issued, and handed to them. So they have to go out and put it into somebody else's hands at a higher interest rate than they're paying to hold it. Okay? Make sense? So they go out and they loan it to people buying a house. So when they loan it to you to buy a house with, all it does is increase your debt-to-income ratio in a bad way. Alright? All it does is put you into higher debt because you can borrow more, but you're not earning more. And what you do earn buys and pays for less. And then they deflate interest rates artificially, and all of this thing is a house of cards. So, what we understand from that hopefully that makes it understandable, that the more money we pump in, without increasing how many people live here, how many people produce things here, and the intrinsic value of our nation, You know, what we can produce and what we can provide to the rest of the world is what our currency is based on today. It's no longer based on gold. So more and more money, just keep pumping it in. That it has to cause prices to go up because it causes the value of the dollar to decline. Now here's the great thing about our Federal Reserve system. There are enough checks and balances, there are enough controls, that if somebody's concerned enough and they keep digging into, those M0, M1, and M2 numbers, and look at all the other reports out there, they can still come up with a number for what M3 is. And I'm going to tell you what M3 has been over the past 27 months here in a second. It's going to scare the crap out of you. It's going to make that 8% number look a little bit lower. All right? Now, so to understand what these shenanigans mean, this hiding of the M3 number really means, and the fact that it's gone up exponentially since they started hiding it, you need to understand another kind of shenanigan thing that's gone on. We used to talk about what was called a consumer price index. That was our main indicator of inflation, how much the cost of living was going up, okay? Again, that was called the consumer price index. That basically looked at everything. Everything out there. How much you paid for your house, how much you paid for gas, how much you paid for a car, how much you paid for insurance, how much you paid for food, right? So clothing, transportation, energy, food. Biggest expenses most people have, okay? Well, what happened was the consumer price index kept going up. And inflation kept going up, and things like Social Security are tied to the inflation rate, so we have to increase the payouts to Social Security, and we take, you know, people and companies are given cost of living increases based on this. So as this inflation goes up, the cost of doing business goes up, and it's this massive upward spiral. We got to do something to fix this. So the first thing that happened is many years ago, they started taking the consumer price index and playing games with it. They would say, okay, well, the price of sirloin has gone up X dollars, but you can still buy ground chuck for, you know, roughly the same price that good sirloin used to be. So we'll just call that meat. Right, and we'll use the upper numbers for meat from before and the lower numbers for meat now, and we'll keep a lid on this inflation number that we have to publish and we have to tell people about. And that'll hold all this stuff down. So your nice top sirloin got replaced with ground chuck in a consumer price index. Even that is eroded now. You can only play that game for so long. So let's go ahead and replace consumer price index with core inflation. Now, you think about core inflation, sounds like they're actually paying more attention to what's going on. The American citizen, the American consumer, disinterested goes, core inflation, okay, yeah, that makes sense here, okay. Core inflation's only 1%, wow, wonderful, we're not in a recession, this is good, this is really good. Hold on, what the hell is core inflation? Here's what core inflation is. Core inflation tracks how much the cost of everything out there goes up, just like the consumer price index, except they leave two things out: energy and food. Let me say that again. The core inflation rate ignores the cost of food and energy. In other words, it ignores the price that you pay to put gas in the tank of your car to go to work every day, as though that number doesn't really affect your personal inflation and how much it costs you to live. It ignores how much it costs you to go to Albertsons or Publix or Winn-Dixie or wherever you shop, Tom Thumb, whatever it is, and buy groceries. Because that doesn't really count. It's not important for the inflation rate. It says that it doesn't matter that your electric bill went up. That's not part of inflation. Now, folks, other than the cost of your actual dwelling, your actual house that you pay for your mortgage, right, which has been artificially kept low by false low interest rates and by a declining housing market, other than that, tell me what your biggest expenses are that are not food or energy. And you're probably going off to, like, car insurance, which is annoying, but it's not what we consider the thing that kills us. What kills us is sliding that bank card into the pump once or twice a week to get to and from work, right? What kills us is the electric bill. to be able to keep our house from being 100 degrees in summertime, even though Barack Obama doesn't think I need to keep my house in the 70s. I'm going to do it. Or to keep from freezing to death in the winter. Fuel, heating oil, electricity, food. Not in the core price index. Or the core inflation rate. So now you start to see how these shenanigans are getting played. So what has actually happened to M3 while everybody's asleep at the switch? Well, I found a website called nowinfutures.com. Nowinfutures.com, and the end is the forward end in the middle. And they say that the M3 number in 2006 was 10.5 trillion, and that today it's 13.5 trillion. 10.25 to 13.5, that means we've had an increase of 32% in 27 months. Now remember, I told you before they started hiding this number that the M3 number was growing at 8%. Alright? It went up 32% in 27 months. Alright? Take 3 months out of it, I mean, we're looking at what? We're looking at about an annual percentage increase now of about 18%. 18% from 8. It's almost doubled. The percentage of increase has almost doubled since they stopped hiding the number. Do you think there's maybe a reason they're hiding that number, that they're not publishing that number? They're not putting it out in one of those annoying Excel spreadsheet-generated line graphs that the average American can look at and go, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't look right. What's the deal with that? So I've talked about all these really big numbers. Trillions of dollars that are out there, and, you know, this stuff is not the most entertaining topic. But it's important to understand. That's why I wanted to do a show on it. But now what I'm going to try to do, to tie this back home to you, to make this personal, to make you get it, to make you understand why it points to very, very bad things for our economy. Why you need to be prepared, why you need to be building up some cash reserves, why you need to be reducing your cost of living, why you need to be eliminating your debt, why you need to be storing food, why you need to be putting in place for yourself a life that gives you the satisfaction you want with far less than you have coming in as income today, why you need to build that life. Because this is what it's really meant. While that number has gone up, that massive increase in 27 months, here's what else has happened that affects the average American consumer. The price of gas has gone from $2.25 a gallon as a national average to $4.10 as a national average. Remember the energy that they don't put in that core inflation rate, right? That number is 82% increase. 82%, just don't worry about it. Doesn't really affect you. 82% more you're paying for gas in the tank of your car. Alright? Flour. Why flour? It's a number I could find, and if you think about what flour is the main ingredient in tremendous amounts of our food supply. Bread, you know, pasta, you think about all these different things that we eat. Flour is a major food component. Price of flour, national average in 2006 was 33 cents. National average in 2008, 53 cents. That's a percentage of increase of 60%. The main ingredient in most of the food that you eat, that's not meat, has gone up 60%. And other food sources such as corn and broccoli and tomatoes and everything like that, vegetables, gone up relatively about the same amount, if not more. So the cost of the food that you eat has increased by about 60%. The price of the gas you put in your car has increased by 82%. And remember, the M3 supply only increased by 32%. So basically, whatever the M3 supply is, whatever that number increases, just count on energy and food, you know, doubling it. All right, because these numbers are higher than double when you aggregate them together. But just call it double. Right, but we're not going to publish that number anymore, and we're not going to include the major expenses that drive your personal expenses in our inflation rate anymore. Beautiful, huh? Let's look at another thing. What has happened to the value of the American dollar in the world? Let's look at two people we consider to be relatively friendly to the United States, and we do business with on a regular basis, the Japanese. Think about how many Japanese cars there are out there, right? Japanese stuff is inexpensive. It's cheap. We don't say cheap in a bad way anymore. I mean, it doesn't cost us much. We like doing business with the Japanese. Well, a dollar bought you 119 yen in 2006, and a dollar only buys you 106 yen today. Okay? Now understand that Japan somewhat manipulates the value of their yen against our dollar. They don't want that. They don't want it to drop too much. They don't like a decrease. It's not good for them. A lot of their economy is based on doing business with us and doing business in a one-way fashion from Japan to the U.S. They like having our dollar be strong, so they don't like it when we weaken. In spite of their efforts to prevent that from happening, that's a 10% drop. 2 years, the value of the U.S. dollar to the Japanese yen has gone down by 10% in spite of Japan's attempt to prevent it from happening. Let's look at Europe and the euro. Well, we could buy about $1.20 in euros, okay, in 2006. A euro bought about $1.20, all right? So if you had a euro, you came to the United States, you cashed it in, you got $1.20. So, you know, your money bought 20% more over here than it did in Europe. That's roughly how it worked, and that's why tourists from Europe like to come here. Their money gets stronger when they get here. Cost of a plane ticket is irrelevant at that point, right? Because you spend most of your money on vacation when you're here. Well, now our friends from Europe can come over and get $1.58 for every euro. That means our value against the euro has had a 24% drop. That number, folks, is the stock price, the value of one share of U.S. stock versus the European economy has declined by 24%. So we have runaway inflation that we're lying to the people about. We have a money supply that's running away. That money supply is depressing the value of a dollar. Everything's getting worse. The housing meltdown has not slowed down at all. People are still losing their houses. Houses are still devalued. And there's millions of Americans stuck in their homes today. They can't get out. They owe more on their house than it's worth, and they're going to be paying for 10 to 15 years to get out of that upside-down situation that they're in. So even they don't contribute to the foreclosure rate because they'll keep working their brains out to keep their house. But they still have a negative debt-to-income ratio, and they're stuck in it for a decade or more. What is the Federal Reserve's solution? What is Bernanke's solution to this problem? Blow more money. I'm not kidding, folks. Just made a statement. Just went out and said, you know, we're going to loan more money. We're going to give more money to the banks. We're going to prop them up. We're going to keep the interest rates depressed and deflated. And we'll just keep pumping more money in. Keep driving. Everything that's making this thing worse, they continue to do. You ask yourself, well, why would they do it? Because it prevents the inevitable from happening today. It stalls the real depression. What I've heard termed online now, and I can't give the guy credit for it, and I'll do a podcast about him in the future and give him credit, called the Greater Depression. The depression that has the inflation of consumer goods of the 70s and the deflation of material assets, real estate, stuff like that, of the 30s combined into a stagflation model. That's what's going to happen. That's what has to happen. This thing has to correct itself, but as long as they play these games, they forestall that occurrence. They prevent it for another day. They put it off till tomorrow. But the reality is, as you build this house of cards, the bigger it gets, the harder the crash is going to be. So, this is, if there's nothing else, right, if you think global warming is a scam, and on some levels I think global warming is a scam, it's designed to put the world into a carbon tax situation, right? It's a way to enforce global socialism, right? So, global warming is like, if you believe that there's more oil out there that they'll tell us about, and that they can pump it anytime they want, and, you know, we'll always be oil, even if the price increases, there'll be oil. If you believe that everything else that could go wrong won't, when you look at this false manipulation of U.S. currency, this false manipulation of the U.S. economy, and then I'm going to bounce one more thing off you as I close this today, just to wake you up if you're not totally awake to this problem yet. I did a podcast recently on the national debt, the public national debt. Remember, there's three sets of books. The public debt, the debt that goes into the Social Security and Medicare fund, the un- unpaid obligations and unfunded obligations that we have to pay our retired people and people on Medicare and Medicaid, right, for the next 50 years, separate set of books. And there's an emergency funding book. And I'm going to find out what the number of that emergency funding books are. Because like the $83 billion that we put into Iraq for our first phase came from emergency spending. And that means it didn't go to the public debt. And it didn't go to the Social Security debt. So that's $83 billion is real money. But just the public debt alone, $51 trillion. Now remember what I told you that the M3 number was. Let me look at it again so I say it right. $13.5 trillion. That's basically all the U.S. dollars that exist everywhere in the world. Everybody's money, if we took all the money from everybody, scratched it together into one giant, massive pile of cash, we'd have $13.5 trillion. And as a nation, just on our public sheet, we owe $51 trillion. We owe $40 trillion, roughly, more than all the American dollars that exist. And the problem is stemming from the fact there's too much money. It's a hole that we can't come out of. We cannot avoid a crash. It's impossible. It's a matter of when, how hard, how long, and what we're going to have to do to get out of it. So I just want people to be in touch with that risk and that reality. That's why we do things about homesteading. That's why we do things about self-sufficiency. That's why we do podcasts here about becoming more independent and less dependent on your government. That's why these things are important. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to think of a podcast either this afternoon during my commute home or one tomorrow morning. It's going to be about some more things that you can do to protect yourself financially from what's coming, because it is coming. And I'm not completely trusting of these people that are out there selling gold and say buy gold. Don't ever take the recommendation by itself to buy something from somebody who sells it. Right? Find somebody that doesn't sell it, that's evaluated it independently, take their recommendation. So I want to do more research for you before I start talking about more ways to hedge off the decline in the dollar and get yourself out of stocks. But if nothing else right now, I would get into safe either bonds or cash assets for the time being. And a little bit of money in gold isn't going to hurt, so putting maybe 10% of your assets there is probably a good idea at least. Anyway, hope you've enjoyed this podcast. I hope I've taken this complex thing, this money supply issue, and made it a little bit easier to understand. And hopefully, you know, if you like what you hear, you'll tell your friends about us. We're starting to pick up some listeners now. I've got about 50 regular listeners now, and that's pretty exciting. And the podcast is really not much more than a week old, so I'm pretty excited about that. We're going to hit 100, and when we hit 100 listeners, guys, I'm gonna give you guys a way that you can help me, and we'll see if we can't grow this thing by the end of the summer to 1,000 listeners to the Survival Podcast. And hopefully that's 1,000 people who I can help make a little bit of difference in their lives and become part of what they use in the preparation for whatever is going to go wrong, because something has to give here. We all know that. Hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and I hope you have a great, wonderful day. And you can holler. It really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.